again. They rallied up the troops. God forgive the sin. Hidden agendas. We fight for truth. No, then there be no need to fight. Love isn't fatal, there's no fatalities. Hate supports U.S. principalities. In this separation, we all suffer. We need to be in love with each other. This isn't training, actual invading. Depleted uranium is raining. Iraq, just know we don't have Bush's back. With a vicious attack, crossing borders with might. On foot, catching flight. For hypocrisy, I will not fight. The Most High loves I, the word won't die. Even after all the times it's been revised. I've been shot by Charlton Heston, and he even autographed the weapon. The bullet was lodged in my left shin. I asked the doctor, and she kept it in.
The stress of waiting for the tension of battle, readying to make war, making peace with their God.
Baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Before their baptism of fire.
You're listening to TruthLoveFreedom.org.
प्यारे दोस्तों, मैं जरा अपने गुरु से ठीक से सीख लूं, फिर मैं आई एम सॉरी माय गुड फ्रेंड लेट मी लर्न इट प्रॉपरली फ्रॉम माय गुरु देन आई विल टीच यू.
ऑल राइट, व्हाट्स अप एवरीबॉडी.
यू डू नॉट नो द आफ्टरनून दैट वी हैव बीन हैविंग टुडे. ऑल्दो यू हर्ड द टेल एंड ऑफ इट.
You heard the scratchy music.
No, that was not me on turntables. Oh my god. This song right here is by DJ Shadow. It's called My Guru. May 30th, 2008, and second show on Revere Radio.
Hello.
So we're going to continue on in this radio show, kind of continuing from where I left off in podcast 4 about the origin of the mystery schools and the founding of religion according to the mystery schools.
The founding of like all religion, you mean? According to the mystery schools?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, all religions originally, allegedly, came from the same place, and at least that's the claim. And we're going to talk some information about that, and it's going to take a long time. I mean, obviously, if you're getting into the origins of religion, volumes have been written on the subject. Of course, we're scraping surfaces again. And as time goes on, I'll pick subjects. I want to go over the vast array of topics that are the most important, and then come back through and pick certain topics and tackle them, you know, one at a time in depth. But right now we're still kind of going over the surface stuff to try to educate and form a foundation for what we're talking about.
Get here, on the same page.
Exactly. Because there's a lot of really interesting things about this stuff that most people don't know. And
so what happened? I heard the laptop the laptop was dropped today.
So to prepare for the radio show, I typically get my equipment ready the day ahead. I get it all set up. I just test it, make sure it's all okay. Because the last thing you want to deal with is
last minute fussing around.
Exactly. Trying to get your crap together so that you can do a radio show. Well,
Guess what?
Yeah, I should have known better. I know when I plugged it in, the thought must have been passing, like, crossed my mind. Do not plug it into this outlet.
Carl plugged it into an outlet that basically made it a low tripwire across his kitchen.
I know. It's totally stupid. My wife, you know, she said no more obstacles, but...
She said no more booby traps.
Booby traps, that's right. So, you know, I plugged it in. I have it on my desk on one side of the room, and I had the wire stretched all the way across to the other side. Not because it needed to be, because I have wires, places to plug it in.
In fact, right now it's not stretched across the kitchen like a tripwire.
But, you know, that's what I did. And this morning my wife comes walking in and trips over the wire. Sends my laptop flying across the room like a boomerang. Well, it's not working quite the same anymore. I don't know exactly what's wrong with it. I tried to load Windows. I had to reboot it for another reason, and it wouldn't even let me load Windows.
It was, for those of you who are familiar, the blue screen of death, where when you load up and all of a sudden it's just light blue with white writing and a bunch of numbers and letters.
And so I went through this process of trying to restore it and all this other stuff, and voila, right before, I mean, I'm talking 10 minutes before we're supposed to go on the air, it loads mysteriously. I don't know what happened. I don't know if I didn't even finish the process of restoring it, and it worked.
He turned it off at 60%.
Because I was like, well, it's screwed now. There's nothing I'm going to be able to do. I might as well give it a shot, right? Because we're about to start the show, and I'm not going to wait until halfway through the show to play my intro song. So I went ahead and loaded it. Voila, it opens up. It works great now. Well, not great. I mean, you heard the whole skipping at the beginning of the song. I don't know what that was about. I'm still trying to figure out what's wrong with this thing. But we have music, and, you know, hopefully it doesn't.
Thank God.
We were going to take calls tonight. I had it all set up. We got our Skype number going. We have the 800 number forwarded to us from Revere Radio. And now we can't take calls because Skype won't open. It won't even open.
Yeah, it starts to open, and then that's it.
Yeah, you get an error message. Yeah. So we're not taking calls.
Sorry, it would have been awesome. We will eventually.
Yeah.
It's going to happen, just not this week.
Yeah. Perhaps, if everything works out, it'll happen next week. I mean, I might have to get a new laptop. I don't know what happened. I mean, obviously, you don't throw laptops across the room and think they're going to be okay. So, whatever. You know, we're going to do what we can. Sorry about that. Maybe next time. On another note, good news for people who have listened to the show in the past. You know, I did an interview with a 32nd degree Freemason, the person who actually authors the website, Freemasonic Info, I think it is. I'm trying to remember what it is exactly.
Something like that.
I'll look it up right now.
What's his name, though? What was his name?
His name is Greg Stewart.
Yeah.
And he has agreed to come back on the show, this time live. And assuming, of course, we get the phones working, you'll be able to call in and speak with Greg, a 32nd degree Freemason, ask him questions. And he's I got to say, you know, I've talked to a lot of Freemasons. I've dealt with a lot of them at this point, and he is very honest, straightforward. You know, if it's a secret, he'll tell you, I can't talk about that. And, you know, where other ones, they try to they always try to not damn themselves because, you know, a lot of times when you get into topics and they start going, I can't talk about that, I can't talk about that, I can't talk about that. And then you say, is it a secret society? They go, no. You know, no, it's not. But I just can't talk about anything. That's all. And, you know, he's pretty straightforward. I think he's a great guy. I enjoyed the interview with him. He was, you know, it was a lot of fun, and we got a lot of good information.
What podcast was it that you did the interview? Was it three or four ago? Two or three?
Good question.
Well, I don't know, but didn't it kind of ignite a little bit of a, not a flame war exactly online, but I know there was a little bit of controversy from it.
Yeah. Well,
a couple of Masonic websites, right?
Yeah, a couple of Masonic websites linked to me, and I went and kind of, cruising around and just checking out what they were saying about us, basically. And, you know, what happened is people who are on both sides of the spectrum, you know, and some people in the middle even were getting into a little bit of a flame war, I think, not bad, but, you know, they were saying one person was making a claim about Freemasonry being, a nursery for the occult. And, you know, some Freemasons obviously disagreed with that. And, you know, and they just kind of made comments back and forth. There was a few posts in regard to it. It was interesting.
Yeah, not to start the argument, but I can't imagine how you could deny an occultic aspect to Freemasonry. I mean, you've got to not know about Freemasonry or not know about the occult.
Right.
Some people just don't like the word, I think, and I don't know. Man.
Right. It's like going to a church, a Christian church, and saying it's not about Christ. You know, when everything around is Christ this, Christ that, and they, you know, like you read any Masonic book, they talk about the occult nonchalantly. It's not like it's occult. And but then again, you got to get into the definition of what occult means. Occult, you know, literally means hidden. Hidden knowledge, or you know, or secret knowledge, or knowledge that's not available to the public, whatever you want to call it. I've heard so many different interpretations of the word occult, and it kind of is synonymous with esoteric to some extent.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, all this stuff is debatable. Everybody has an opinion about it, and I try to, you know, have a balanced opinion. I have my own opinions, but I don't, you know, I'm more or less about teaching people information and letting them make up their own mind. And but Greg was great. We did a two-hour interview. I mean, afterward, it was like I should have, you know, mailed the guy a freaking haul. You know what I'm saying? Something for his throat, because, you know, he was sick even that day, and he toughed it out. You know, and I had been looking for like a year trying to find somebody to do it, and I couldn't get anybody.
Yeah, there had been some close calls, like you almost got to interview some people,
right?
If I remember right. And
yeah.
It just turned into like, no, like they kept pulling out at the last minute or whatever. Kind of for a while, it felt like it wasn't even going to happen.
Yeah, that's how it felt. Yeah, I pretty much had thrown my hands up in the air, and then I get an email from him saying, hey, let's do it. And then I was thinking, okay, you know, this is probably like somebody, you know, on this, you know, in the Blue Lodge trying to, you know, climbed the levels and hasn't really experienced Freemasonry for a long time. And then he's like, no, I'm a 32nd degree Scottish Rite. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, like, regardless of what you believe about it, Freemasons don't believe that it matters. Obviously, people who research Freemasonry and are critical of it do think it matters, because there's this enigma of whether or not there's the higher degrees.
You mean like over the 30?
Right, or like that you're not really in led into the know until you get to a degree high enough that they actually reveal to you what it's really all about.
Right.
You're kind of kept in the dark. And, you know, there's various quotes to confirm that. Not going to debate it. Not interested in it. You know, I'm just interested in giving the different opinions. But, yeah, we're going to have him on. Greg Stewart. He's actually the website is...
That's Ron Paul.
Yeah, that's
Ron. Sorry.
Okay, there it is. MasonicTraveler.com.
Oh, okay.
That's his blog, personal blog. He goes by the Masonic Traveler. He's pretty well known among Freemasons. And he also does FreemasonInformation.com. So I believe it's .com. Yeah. Anyways, Greg Stewart. Going to be on 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite. It's exciting. So let's see here. Anything else to announce?
Besides that I have high cholesterol, I found out. No, nothing else to announce.
Okay.
It's depressing. I'm 31. And I have to change my diet and start exercising. So anyone who can relate to that understands.
Yeah, exactly. So let's see here. We are doing today's broadcast, as like I said, a continuation of podcast 4, when it was a podcast, when the show was a podcast, on the ancient mystery schools and cults, the foundation of religion and their philosophy.
Yeah, can you kind of just really quickly recap what you did in that that last podcast, the podcast number 4, just for anyone who hasn't heard it?
Okay, in the please do go listen to it.
I mean, yeah, it's a pretty cool podcast, actually.
Yeah. And I promised somebody that I would recap from the last show, so let me do that first. From the last show, we got into the topics of free speech and what it's all about, and essentially, I think we just soapboxed it. I don't think we really came to any conclusions. I don't even know really what to say about it. I mean, to try to encapsulate everything that was said is kind of hard to do. But
yeah, we just kind of talked about it. I think it's something we're both kind of passionate about, and it was fun to do, I think, just to talk about it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So... sorry, I can't give any more information than that, but that's...
Oh, because we don't have it recorded, huh?
Yeah, we did not record
the
show.
Sorry, guys, you missed a gem of a show.
I posted on the website, you know, that I accidentally did not click the appropriate button, and I did click the appropriate button this time, I think. I'm pretty sure I did.
We'll check
Let me just make sure here. It is.
It is. I see it. It's clicked.
Oh, yes. Okay. So we're good, hopefully, assuming, of course, that this thing is actually going to work, and it would be a shame if it didn't, because I'm going to have to re-record this. But Because it's important information, the stuff that we're getting into. So to recap on podcast four, basically what I did is I went through and wrote out and gave some quote and a few links to information about it, but basically got into the foundations of religion according to those who are participate in what is referred to as the mystery schools of modern day. And basically what it does is it talks about how man went from a primitive state to an intellectual state, how some were more considered more superior, how that happened, the process through the taming of fire is a significant aspect of it. It's part of this whole process, which they refer to as creating order out of chaos. And basically, yeah, you just go and listen to it. It's really hard to encapsulate, but if you hear the story, you'll understand. And this is where they're coming from. Then I give you a link to somebody from the Theosophical Society who actually published a book called The Mystery Schools. And you can go through and read it, and it literally says nearly what I said. I mean, there's different versions of it, and it varies, but the idea and the concept and the philosophy remains. It's the same. So check it out. So today we're going to continue on from where that left off, and where that left off was that the actual creation of what was called the Mystery Schools. Now, that was prior to civilization as we know it. There was tribes, there were people who lived in certain areas, small villages, things like that. But this, before it created the first empires and cities and governments and things of that sort, those things came into being.
Those things came into being because of this kind of organizing religious thing, or?
Well, it's because what happened was is that the people who are considered the philosophers of the mystery cults or the mystery schools, whatever you want to call them, the priesthood. Mm-hmm. Okay, the priesthood supposedly had intuition. Some, now, like I said, there's different versions of the story, and I'm giving my interpretation of what I've read. The people who also teach on this that are a little bit more of the superstitious aspects of it don't agree with me. I'll say that straight out. They just don't agree with me, and that's fine. You know, the evidence, I guess, we'll have to make, you know, you'll have to make a judgment call on what you think is the most accurate, but you have to research it first. But basically, they teach that these people had intuitions that allowed them to realize that the world was not governed by God or gods. It was actually governed by regular occurring forces in nature. And this intellect was birthed. It's symbolic. I don't think it's actual, but it's kind of symbolic that what happened was, and this is symbolic, whenever you see a lightning bolt striking a tree, like there's actually a production company that shows that.
I think it's Jerry Bruckheimer, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see the car driving down the, I guess you're like a car, you're going down the street or whatever, and then all of a sudden a lightning bolt strikes a dead tree and it brings it to life. Mm. It's symbolic of that. Basically, the story goes that a lightning bolt struck a tree, that the man found the fire and was able to break off a branch and keep fire and actually tame an element for the first time. That was considered symbolic of the birth of intellect, the birth of reason. And with his eyes open for the first time, not being in fear of the fire, but realizing that it could be put to good use, like keeping him warm at night, cooking food,
right,
protecting him from predators, things like that, that he was able to see that the elements could be utilized, that they didn't need to be feared. Because before, anything that was unexplained, like if lightning came down from heaven, to primitive people, they thought that was God punishing or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And so to him, that was the first time he realized that, no, this is not God. This is just something, this, you know, an element. He had control of it, and he, for the first time, looked around and started trying to analyze his environment to see what could be utilized for the purpose of for his purposes, basically. Mm-hmm. That, and the idea behind this is that he at that very moment was the birth of intellect. In other words, he stopped being superstitious. He was able to look around in his environment and realize that he could use science. He was the first scientist, mm-hmm, use science to control the elements for his own good.
Yeah.
Eventually, people started attaching themselves to this person, and he allegedly gave his knowledge freely. Okay, I'm encapsulating basically everything I did, but still go back and listen to it because there's a lot more detail. And that the people around him that were primitive people would use those things like fire and would use them against other people and things like that. They're still fearful of them, and they weren't really being responsible with the knowledge. So the knowledge needed to be concealed. Mm. And they created elaborate myths and stories in, of about gods and things like that to explain to the people who were primitive, who were not able of understanding this concept of there not being a god, like to tame them, to basically keep them under control, because if not, they would rape. And like I gave one example, if there was a, you know, a drought or something like that, and they had no food, whatever food they had stored away needed to be portioned out so that they can get through, rationed. What the instinct would tell you to go and cram all that food in your face and get quicker. So it would actually kill them. So it shows, it's basically to give a lot of different examples. I just picked a few off the top of my head to give. But that, you know, that's basically the idea. So they needed to control the people because they were too primitive. This is not a story I embrace as being truth. It's just what I picked up through my studies.
It's my experience, which, I mean, I admit I haven't read everything. I've done some research trying to find anything other than speculation about this, something that tries to prove that this is indeed one way or the other what happened. And I mean, when you get back that far, it gets murky. And no matter what certain writers say, especially at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, there were a lot of writers who talked about this stuff like it was absolutely, positively, 100% proven and true. I mean, it's not necessarily that easy. It's not that simple. It's definitely not. I mean, it's something to keep in mind, definitely.
Yeah.
But it's basically, I mean, it's kind of like a theory of how the myths arose.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, we don't have history that goes back that far. We only have we have some history, but it's real.
It's spotty. Yeah, and I mean, so much of it, it's like a fragment of, you know, something that was written on a tablet. So you've got a fragment, and you've got, you know, maybe you can put together some scenarios based on artifacts that you find. But as far as, like, here's a narrative story of what happened, it's just not there.
Right.
And anything that even remotely looks like it was written very long after the fact.
Right, absolutely. And see, that's just it. There's no way to either prove or disprove it. It's just one of the ideas, and it actually is a fundamental aspect behind what is known as the mystery cults of modern day, at least. They get into this whole thing. So I'm going to continue on from where I left off there, and it's going to actually sound like I just started out of nowhere. So, I mean, if you haven't heard the past stuff, then, you know, this is going to sound like that, but... bear with it and definitely go listen to it, and then I'll have this podcasted if it does actually record, and you can listen to it again right after it, and you'll understand where it's coming from and how it's continuing that story. So, all right. So the ancient mystery schools and / cults, the foundations of religion and their philosophy. This is like a very, and this is going to be a multiple shows. I'm going to keep going on this topic for a while. So this is the very, very bare minimum. I was trying to get as much done as possible, but even then, this is, trust me, it's a mindful.
Yeah, I mean, people's lives have been devoted to this stuff.
Right, exactly, and I'm trying to shuffle it together in the course of a week every week. So, so here we go. The formulation of the first religious system was simple and yet contained an aura of mystery so incomprehensible to the average citizen that they accepted the explanations provided by the priesthood without question. Simple questions required only simple explanations. But once the simple questions were answered, more complicated questions sprang up in the minds of the citizenry. Elaborate myths and stories were created to explain the unexplainable, and the traditions of handing down these stories from one generation to the next were incorporated into ceremonies and holidays. To conceal the truth from the masses of ignorant people, the use of symbols was employed and became the primary means of communication among the mystery schools. The priesthood directed the people to a rich soil area between the Tigris and Euphrates River to establish a permanent home capable of feeding and sustaining the people. Among their ranks rose a charismatic leader who was adorned by the villagers for his courage and strength. His name was Nimrod. He is called the first to become, quote, a mighty one on the earth, unquote, and, quote, the mighty hunter before the Lord, unquote.
Are those both, those are biblical quotes, or just the second one, or where do those quotes come from?
They're both from the Bible.
Yeah.
He was said to have founded many of the large cities in Mesopotamia and organized the first government, at the head of which was Babylon. Now, that's been refuted. Some say that it is actually Nineveh, and that Babylon was the religious city. I don't know. I love I always have to throw in these little angles, but when you get into this stuff, it's just like, God, there's like 20 different people saying 20 different things.
Yeah, it's interesting too, that that we're talking about, like, it's along the same theme of like controlling the element of fire and being able to kind of like that being a doorway to a realization that there's other things that can be controlled. And this idea of moving to an area where the soil is so rich and where there's the Tigris and the Euphrates is just like further along in that same direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of basically just like being able to exploit and use the environment instead of it being something basically that can go and turn against you at any moment.
Right, exactly. And so that's exactly, you know, the mentality that these people now had embraced the sciences. They had developed weapons. They had developed, agriculture. They've developed a lot of different things. And now they were looking for a place where they could set up a city for the first time, a civilization, so they would no longer have to wander. And it led them to this place. History supports that's where a lot of it was founded. Sumer and all that, where, you know, the civilizations had been, you know, came to. And of course, I'm going really fast because history shows that it took a long time and a lot of progress. But, you know, the point remains the same. This is where they went and so on. Under Nimrod's rule, his nation flourished and grew. It came to pass that Nimrod, being aware of the higher mysteries, sought to teach the higher mysteries to the masses of people. As Josephus tells it, quote, "Now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man, and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as it were through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured their happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence on his power. Now the multitude were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod, and to esteem it a piece of cowardice to submit to God. And they built a tower, neither sparing any pains nor being in any degree negligent about the work. And by reason of the multitude of hands employed in it, it grew very high, sooner than anyone could expect. But the thickness of it was so great, and it was so strongly built, that thereby its great height seemed, upon the view, to be less than it actually was, or really was. It was built of burnt brick, cemented together with mortar, made in bitumen, I don't know how to say that it might not be liable to admit water. When God saw they acted so madly, he did not resolve to destroy them utterly, since they had not grown wiser by the destruction of their former sinners. He's referring to the flood. But he caused a tumult among them by producing in them diverse languages, and causing that through the multitude of those languages they should not be able to understand one another. The place wherein they built the tower was called Babylon, because of the confusion of that language which they readily understood before. For the Hebrews mean by the word Babel confusion. Okay, so that's a quote from Josephus. Now, it is said that Josephus based much of his views on legend and portrayed Nimrod unfairly. So, and a lot of people believe that. Of course, you know, you got to be careful, because whenever you get into biased opinions, even if, you know, it's Josephus, which is pretty established, you know, there are people who say, hey, that wasn't fair, you know, or whatever. So, whether or not he was a tyrant is debatable. He is credited with having built, many of the cities in the Babylonian Empire. Since then, science has questioned whether or not he has even existed or is the product of legend. My goal is not to deal with these questions, but to merely point out that up until recent history, his existence did not come into question, and he is important to the understanding of what the mystery schools believe. Okay, and we'll get into why. So, and okay, like I said, this is not a religious teaching, but we deal in topics of religion. I'm not here to tell you whether Nimrod existed or didn't exist. I'm here to tell you about a certain group of people who have a certain belief system.
Yeah, and what that belief leads to.
Right,
because it really is immaterial whether or not this is how history happened to coalesce or whatever, if the end result is a certain set of philosophies and beliefs that affect, you know, the way people think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Albert G. Mackey is a 33rd degree Mason of the Scottish Rite, and regarded as Masonry's greatest historian. At least that's what I've read from, you know, the New Age magazine.
You mean like historian like of Masonry?
Right. He's the greatest historian in about Masonry, yeah. And this is what he says about Nimrod. Quote, "The legend of the craft in the old constitution refers to Nimrod as the one of the founders of Masonry. Thus, in the York manuscript number 1, we read, quote, "At ye making of ye tour of Babel, there was Masonry, first much esteemed of, and the king of Babylon, yet was called Nimrod, was a Mason himself, and loved well Masons." Okay, unquote. And the Cook manuscript thus repeats the story. Quote, "And this same Nimroth began the Tower of Babylon, and he taught to his workmen the craft of Masonry, and he had with him many Masons, more than 40,000, and he loved and cherished them well," unquote. The idea no doubt sprang out of the scriptural teaching that Nimrod was the architect of many cities, a statement not so well expressed in the authorized version as it is in the improved one of Bochart, which says, quote, "From the land of Nimrod went forth to Ashur and builded Nineveh," sorry, I'm trying to read this, it's like old English, "and Rehoboth city in Calah," and how do you say these words?
I don't know, Resen, between Resen, Nineveh and Calah.
"And between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city," unquote. So here he is making a quote that, you know, that Nimrod was considered one of the founding people. And, you know, of course, Masonry does not have a Bible. So, you know, any Masons are welcome to believe whatever they want. And just because he says it doesn't necessarily mean that all Masonry believes that. But you'll find that a lot of Masons do, because he's not the only one that's quoted as saying it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't like to be absolutist about everything. So I'm not saying that Masonry endorses this belief system. However, it's something to take into consideration, because there's lots of people who do that look to people like Albert G. Mackey, and they read things like that and they believe it. So whatever, you know. In regards to the topic of Nineveh, he wrote this: "The capital of the ancient kingdom of Assyria and built by Nimrod. The traditions of its greatness and its magnificence of its building were familiar to the Arabs, the Greeks, and the Romans. The modern discoveries of Rich, of Boda, and of other explorers have thrown much light upon the ancient condition, and have shown that it was the seat of much architectural splendor and of a profoundly symbolic religion," okay, "which had something of a characteristic of Mithraic worship. In the mythical relations of the old constitutions, which make up the legend of the craft, it is spoken of as the ancient birthplace of Masonry, where Nimrod, who was its builder, and, quote, was a Mason and loved well the craft, unquote, employed 60,000 Masons to build it, and gave them a charge, quote, that they should be true, unquote. And this, says Harleian, manuscript number 1942, was the first time that any Mason had any charge of craft." So basically they're saying this is the birth of architecture, of Masonry, of everything.
Yeah, Masonry meaning just literally stonework in this case.
But it also says that it was preserved in its works, was preserved a symbolic tradition. Let me see where it's at. Symbolic religion. So, okay, well, let's see. "And have shown that it was the seat of much architectural splendor and of a profoundly symbolic religion, which had something of the characteristics of Mithraic worship." So, you know, what does Masonry have? Tons of symbols. Obviously, there's more than just the fact that it's on a solid state. There is symbolic representation there. We're talking about religion, and they quote often from Babylonian, well, not often, but, you know, relatively in comparison to all the other world religions.
Mm-hmm. What is Mithraic worship?
Mithra. It's a form of worship that they did for Mithra, and we'll get into that another time.
Okay.
I can't quote things like that off the top of the head. It's just too much for me. But so Mackey, the same author, also stated in his book, History of Freemasonry, on chapter 12, The Legend of Nimrod, "The universal sediment of the Masons of the present day is to confer upon Solomon, king of Israel, the honor of being their, quote, first grand master, unquote. But the legend of the craft has long had long before thought there was a tradition of the temple extant bestowed, at least by implication, that the title upon Nimrod, the king of Babylonia and Assyria. It had attributed the first organization of a fraternity of craftsmen to him, and saying that he gave charge to the workmen whom he sent to assist the king of Nineveh in building his cities. This is to say, he framed for them the constitution, and, in the words of the legend, quote, this was the first time that ever masons had any charge of his science, unquote. I think it's of this science. I think I spelled that wrong. It was the first time that the craft were organized into fraternity. You want to read?
Yeah, sure. It was the first time that the craft were organized into a fraternity working under a constitution or body of laws. And as Nimrod was the autocratic maker of these laws, it results as a necessary consequence that their first legislator, legislating with dictatorial and unrestricted sovereign power, was also their first grandmaster.
So, you know what I'm saying? I would like to elaborate on it because I have my beliefs about this, and I do not doubt that there are plenty of Freemasons that will disagree with me. Fine. It's fine with me. But basically what they're saying is that Freemasonry is the quest for knowledge. Okay, it is a pathway to the search for God. They do never endorse a particular God, but there is an implication that if you get it, you will believe certain things. Okay. And that is illustrated by the way you go through your ceremonies and things that are said and blah, 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 the lessons that you learn and so on. Now, they're saying that Nimrod, it could in fact be considered the Grand Master to some extent.
Yeah, like the first original Grand Master before even, David or Solomon? Who are they saying? Solomon was the first, right?
Right.
According to present day belief.
Right, because the first 30 degrees deals in the building of Solomon's temple. And that's where they get a lot of their symbolism in masonry about the building of the temple of God, okay? The building of the temple of God is symbolic of your temple. You're the temple of God, okay? And it's building character is what they always refer to it as. So building the temple of God refers to building your character on an external level, but it goes much deeper than that. And we'll get into that later. We're going to get to Solomon's temple on another podcast, or broadcast, I should say. But Nimrod was the first person to build these cities. He was basically alleged to be, according to the Bible, which history now refutes because they have other names of people, and they've even tried to link these people together, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But as far as people knew before history had proven otherwise, it was believed that Nimrod was the foundation of basically the first government, the first priesthood, the first religious system, the first everything. One of the earliest texts we have available to us is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which came from Babylon. So, you know what I'm saying? There's people who are debating things too. Obviously, Egypt plays a part of this, and we'll get into Egypt later. You know, I have to stay on one topic at a time. But, you know, it is definitely significant, at least to the earlier times of Masonry, before history had started to refute many of the claims that were made in the Bible and so on. And we'll get into those. Now, Eliphas Levi proclaimed in his book, The History of Magic, quote, let us now reconstruct in thought the great metropolitan cities of Assyria, Babylon, and Nineveh. Let us restore to their proper place the granite colossi. Let us formulate the massive temples held up by elephants and sphinxes. Let us raise once more the obelisks from the dragons, which the dragons look down with shining eyes and wings outspread. Temples and palaces tower above these wondrous piles, forever concealed but manifested also for every forever by the fact that forever concealed but manifested also forever by the fact of their miracles. The priesthood and the royalty, like visible divinities of earth, abide therein. Okay, I'm going to skip down a little bit. He continues. The monarch himself is sacred. He is a god on earth. The people lie prone as he passes, and the maniac who would attempt to cross the threshold of his place falls dead immediately by the intervention of an invisible hand and without stroke or mace or sword. He is slain as if by the bolt, blasted by fire from heaven. What religion and what power? How mighty are the shadows of Nimrod, Belus, and Semiramis? Now, Eliphas Levi was a 33rd degree Freemason. He authored the book History of Magic. A.E. Waite translated that from Latin to English, and that's the translation that I have. And A.E. Waite was a Mason as well. Now, A.E. Waite said that he was perhaps the greatest ever. And a lot, what's really interesting is there's quotes that come from Albert Pike's book about, you know, one about Lucifer came from Eliphas Levi. So, Eliphas Levi is considered the greatest work on magic in history, basically, by many, many people. So, transcendental magic, of course. So, anyways, so, any comments on that?
No, not just yet.
And the point I'm getting with is that, you know, here's another Mason, totally agreeing with the point. He looks at that as a glorious time in history where the priesthood and the government were one. And, you know, he believed it to be, like, there was people who believed that Babylon was actually a city from heaven on earth. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? All the buildings were supposed to be built with architecture, and then we'll get in that in just a second. So I have more to read. And I'm not very good. I'm probably going to let you read it.
Okay, I got this.
Okay, we're starting right there.
Right there? Yeah, all right, so top. In the New York Times bestseller, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, author Karen Armstrong states this. Like other people in the ancient world, the Babylonians attributed their cultural achievements to the gods who had revealed their own lifestyle to their mythical ancestors. Thus, Babylon itself was supposed to be an image of heaven, with each of its temples a replica of a celestial palace. The link with the divine world was celebrated and perpetuated annually in the Great New Year Festival, which had been firmly established by the 17th century BCE. Celebrated in the holy city of Babylon during the months of Nisan, or April, the festival solemnly enthroned the king and established his reign for another year. Yet this political stability could only endure insofar as it participated in the more enduring, effective governments of the gods who had brought order out of primordial chaos when they had created the world.
There's that order out of chaos again.
Oh, no, this is a more recent book, right?
This is.
Yeah.
Actually, I have it right there right next to you on the left. It's one of those books. We'll get you the actual date of it. So, basically, it was a religious form of government, and it said that its political stability can only endure insofar as it participated in the more enduring, effective governments of the gods. So basically, when the separation of God, the gods from the government that would that, and she's referring to it bringing an order out of primordial chaos when they created the world. Order out of chaos. You hear it over and over again. I just keep wanting to emphasize order out of chaos. Order out of chaos. You heard it in the Zbigniew Brzezinski's book. You've heard it. Mm-hmm. I know I've said it before. I don't remember any other things. Probably Blavatsky and everything else.
Yeah, definitely.
Order out of chaos. What does it mean? Because it is the motto of the 33rd degree. Order ab cal.
Oh, the 33rd degree? Really?
Freemasonry.
Interesting.
And it's worth noting. I'm not going to tell you what it means. You're going to have to figure it out for yourself. But you'll hear it over and over and over again in the same context. And you'll get an idea of what it means. So The History of God is what was published?
93, it looks like.
1993. New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, so I mean, the other stuff, you know, we got several hundred years old, some of it, but it's no different than what's still being written today in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, I can understand the attractiveness of the theory that more or less that this is how things happen. I mean, it is an attractive theory, and it seems to make some psychological sense to imagine, you know, that things might have really happened this way. Mm-hmm. Might have, you know, there's a part, just hearing it, there's a part of it that it's like I could imagine it being true. Not that that's worth anything, but
yeah, exactly.
But I find it super fascinating. Mm-hmm. If not terribly, it's not really terribly substantiated by anything, but it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
like I said, and I'm not trying to convince you one way or another. I'm just trying to tell you information. The stuff where I try to convince you comes later. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not interested in convincing you. I'm really just interested in providing you with the information so you can make up your own mind about it. Now, later on in her book, on the history of God, she has, in under the chapter, Does God Have a Future? Now, you're going to find this quote pretty interesting, at least I did. Human beings cannot endure emptiness and desolation. They will fill the vacuum by creating a new focus of meaning. The idols of fundamentalism are not good substitutes for God. If we are to create a vibrant new faith for the 21st century, we should perhaps ponder the history of God for some lessons and warnings.
It's interesting.
I thought that was pretty interesting. Now,
the idols of fundamentalism are not good substitutes for God. What does that mean?
Well, you know, you have to read her book to understand.
Right.
Now, this, understand, this is a book about comparative religion.
Right.
So basically what she's doing is doing what Masonry has been doing, which is they compare similarities in religions. They say, look at this and how it connects to that and blah, blah, blah. And you trace it back and you kind of say this came from that idea and you and basically originated in the same place. So, interesting stuff. let's see. Now, she continued on. You want to go ahead and...
Yeah, sure. The 11 sacred days of the festival. This is talking about the New Year festival, right? When it takes place like in our April. The 11 sacred days of the festival thus projected the participants outside profane time into the sacred and eternal world of the gods by means of ritual gestures. A scapegoat was killed to cancel the old dying year. The public humiliation of the king and the enthroned carnival king in his place reproduced the original chaos. A mock battle reenacted the struggle of the gods against the forces of destruction.
Okay.
Destruction.
Right. Now, this is the reason I put this in here is because it refers to what I said earlier and my little thing that I wrote, which is that the rituals and the holidays that were set up were done so to create a constant reminder. Okay. They had a specific aim, and that was to educate and remind the citizenry that chaos and destruction was imminent if they ever decided that the priesthood should not rule.
Hmm.
That's the idea. And you see governments doing that constantly. They're, you know, they'll be the first ones to remind you how horrible things would be without them.
Yeah.
Right? and that is, I think, the essence to some extent, not the full essence, but definitely an aspect of it in the idealism that has kind of affected government in the world, which is that the intellectuals are creating order out of chaos.
Yeah.
And without them, there's just chaos.
Yeah, definitely. And this is definitely not to get political, but that attitude finds voice and kind of like a barely hidden disdain for actual democracy. I mean, people don't really trust a lot of the people in charge don't really trust the people to make decisions. And I mean,
right.
that's definitely an example of this still happening.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And, you know, if you go to like podcast 4 where I go into it, that's exactly the conclusion that they came to, is that the people needed to be controlled.
Mm-hmm. Let us think that maybe we're making decisions for ourselves, but.
Right. Exactly. And that's what we get into later because it wasn't, I mean, The first governments that were founded under the principle of dictatorships. Like, basically, you know, we're gods on earth. People feared God, therefore they feared the god's representative.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they even had the audacity to call themselves gods.
Yeah, and it was, I'm sure, believed to some
extent,
too. Right,
it was. Not only that, because, you know, the real root of magic or magi's was the use of science. I mean, you think of chemistry.
Yeah, what we now call
alchemy.
Science.
Yeah,
it was, you know, wasn't known as such then, but it's like
then it was magic.
Yeah,
you know, if you could make a balloon float up in the air and fly, that's magic.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
or
not,
you could, you know, make fire out of a rock, you know, like, yeah. Which is basically what you can do with gunpowder, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to the primitive mind, all these things were explained as magic and something of the gods. The scientists, the people who realized this, used these things to dazzle. And they, like I said, they used various, and I said this in podcast 4, they used various concoctions as a way to manipulate the masses into believing. They'd have some kind of spiritual encounter, you know, like by using drugs. And that's, and the idea behind all this is that it was all done to, because the man was too primitive to rule himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the ethic that's taught through that whole process. And, The thing that's really interesting about Nimrod, though, is that Nimrod
decided otherwise. He decided to go ahead and eliminate the idea of God and try to get them to follow him. And I think in the next one we'll get into what happened with that whole situation, because it didn't actually end up being a good idea.
For Nimrod.
So, anyways, so let's go ahead and go to a break.
Sure.
I'm going to play a song here that I think you guys will like. Hopefully you will. I like it. And we'll be back in just a second.
Thank you.
We're back.
Hello.
So. Okay, so we're doing a lot of reading. I'm sorry. I hope this isn't boring the crap out of you. But it's important stuff because of the fact that what it means in terms of history and the philosophy and the religion itself. And I'm going to read this quote. I've read it. I've read it over and over again. I'm going to continue to read it over and over again because it does, in my opinion, it makes very clear the mentality that I'm talking about. You have to understand it. It's so important to what I'm teaching you for to understand the mentality of the people behind it. My purpose behind this is worldview. I want you to understand the worldview of those who you believe are ruling the world. Okay? And that's preaching to the choir a little bit there, but yeah, just for a second. For those who are uninitiated into all these things, let me talk to the choir for just a second. Choir?
Yes.
These things need to be understood. You know, if you really have a problem with the way the direction things are going in and you don't like what it's all about, then it's important that you understand the people and why they're doing what they're doing, what the mentality is. And I think there's a huge fallacy in thinking that everything is so simplistic. You know, a lot of people boil things down to things like greed and power. It's not that. I can guarantee it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, the tendency for people to boil stuff down to one thing, it's like that makes good motivation if you're writing a fictional book or something, mm-hmm. that someone has one all-powerful motivation, but it's not the real world's not that simple.
Right, absolutely. And people are complicated. There are disagreements even within people of this belief system. It's not like they all agree, okay? This is a developing philosophy that has been developing for, in my opinion, several thousand years. I mean, and they all have contributed to some extent to the final conclusion. And the conclusion is not always the same. It's about the same. The mentality seems to be the same. My problems with it seem to be consistent. You know what I'm saying? With each part of it, you know, I believe everybody should have the right to believe what they want. But there's some people who do not believe that I should have the right to believe what I want.
Right. That's where it gets mildly tricky. But yeah, totally. Like, you can believe whatever you want. And then, oh, well, you believe I can't believe that you can believe whatever you want.
Right. Exactly. So there's a catch-22 here. And that's my big objection. And I believe there's only one type of society that could actually benefit everybody.
And that is?
Oh, I'll talk about that.
Oh, sorry.
I'll talk about that another time because that's more on the political side of things. But the religious and the political go hand in hand. You can't avoid it. Dude, everybody who has ever ruled has had a religious view. Even if they're atheists, that is somewhat of a view of the world that is affecting their politics.
And regardless of what you believe even about atheism as some kind of a worldview, like – there have been so few world leaders who actually were atheists in so many world leaders and world systems that if not explicitly founded on and connected to religion, look at America, just not to get current political, but you cannot have a presidential candidate who's an atheist in America. It just can't happen. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're supposedly close to a secular country, you know.
Right. And, you know, that's the whole thing.
you just can't separate the things out.
Regardless hand in hand.
Yeah, regardless of how like idealistic you want to be about separation of these things, you're a human being.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
There's clearly a religious impulse in human beings. You know, you can't deny that.
Mm-hmm. So if there is this so-called hierarchy of people who are ruling things, we need to understand what they think. What do they believe? You know, and I've gotten into some politics for a while now. Now I'm going back into the religion. I'm going to go back into politics again. I'm just going to kind of go back and forth because you'll be surprised. A lot of the stuff that I'm talking about on the religious side of things and a lot of the stuff I'm talking about on the political side of things are exactly the same. It's exactly the same. It's the same conclusions, the same agenda, the same beliefs, the same quotes. They even use the same words, everything. It's exactly the same. You could call that a coincidence. I personally don't. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence. But let's get more into what they believe. And I could just tell you they're all Luciferian twits, but that's not going to help you understand them very well,
right.
Is it? You know, I'm not interested in doing that. Here's the quote.
Who is this? Pike?
Eliphas Levi.
Oh, Levi. Okay.
History of Magic. Now, there are two classes, free men and slaves. Man is born into the bondage of his passions, but he can reach emancipation through intelligence. Between those who are free already and those who are as yet are not, there is no equality possible. The part of reason is to rule and of instinct to obey. Now those who are in liberation should govern those who are in bondage, and slaves are called to be released, not from the government of the free, but from the yoke of brutal passions, as a consequence of which they cannot exist without masters.
I hate that quote.
But it's so... I when I read it, I got chills.
Yeah.
At the time, I actually believed he was right. So right. I was like...
Oh, that's interesting.
I was like, that makes sense. Because you got to think about it. I mean, history has proven that there is some truth to what they're saying.
Yeah.
And the truth is that people who are superstitious and do not use their brains and do not believe in the deeper sense of equality will burn people at the stake for saying the world is round.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened, and it'll happen again. Things like that always happen in a society. Is that, you know, and so they have a good point, you know, about these things. And, you know, once eventually everybody figures out and there's enough proof, I mean, what was it? Was it just, I could have swore I heard a couple years ago that the Catholic Church finally just admitted that the, something about the possibility that there might be life on other planets.
Oh, yeah, that was actually that was real recent. It wasn't, really? It was like within the last month, I think. Life on other planets. It wasn't necessarily saying that it's possible so much as that it doesn't contradict any of the teachings of the church. It's right. Compatible with the teachings of the church, right. Is I think what it basically boiled down to.
Right. And, you know, they change with the times very slowly, you know, and, but that's kind of how mankind is. There was until about 5 years ago, a group of people who believed that the earth was flat. They were the flat earth people. I went to their website, dude. They actually existed. They had a whole bunch of evidence and biblical scripture proving that the earth is flat.
Wow.
And then recently they just disappeared. I guess they finally got it. Maybe they saw enough pictures. They talked to enough people who had been in space. I don't know what it took. You know what I'm saying? For them to believe it. But they eventually didn't start believing that the earth is indeed round. That's a problem, you know, because when you get into ideologies like this that people who are not intellectual or won't use their brain and are ruled by passion, which is a primitive instinct to these people. They look at it like, you know, evolution was necessary. It happened. And that before we had the intellect, we used instinct
mm-hmm.
and emotion to be our guide. And then when intellect took over, the emotional aspects became needless.
Yeah, like intellect basically gets rid of the need for instinct in right. a way, and that people who kind of give in, quote, to their instincts and their passions are somehow lesser. They're not taking advantage of what basically the facilities that they have.
Right, right. They look at it like it's more of a hindrance than a help. You know, they acknowledge that it's there, but they really do have a kind of a view of it as being kind of like a curse. It's kind of like a cancer of intellect.
Interesting.
And that the people who are further evolved are the ones who have the capacity to deny those aspects of themselves and focus purely on the intellectual. And that's a very humanistic worldview.
What does that look like in practice, though, I wonder?
In practice, it looks at, okay, everyone's going to die someday.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable. We're all going to die. So being that there are some people who are a hindrance on society, why feed and water these people and take care of them when they're hindering? Let's get rid of the old people,
right.
The people who are disabled, the people who are retarded.
Why does it always turn so monstrous? I mean,
well, because
is there like no other – is there any other way that this – I don't know. This way of thinking, is this the only thing it can lead to? Can it lead to something that's at least a little bit?
Well, there are some arguments on natural. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I'll have to look it up after the next break and I'll talk about it. But he had an argument for the natural aspect of morality.
Yeah, like, I've read some stuff on that before, definitely.
And I'm trying to remember the guy's name, and I'll look it up. And you know, there's people who have argued this, but most of the people who are on a mission to formulate a utopian society of their vision they're not interested in these other guys' views. I mean, honestly, they've pretty much got their mind made up. You know, I've read things to the effect, and they don't look at it as monstrous. I mean, it's monstrous to you because from their view, you're emotional.
Right.
And you would see it as a monstrous thing. You would feel sick in your stomach. You'd have emotion about it. They don't. They look at it like, look, if it, they don't just look at it like we need to kill them. They look at it like they should give their life for society. Mm. They should be the ones that have enough love, so to speak, that they're willing to exit this world on the behalf of the general society. You know, it's all for one and one for all type of thing. You know, and if you're a hindrance on society, then you should, you know, either pick up and find a use or get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't, you know, because they don't look at death as like something to be feared. And that's why the whole death cult thing, we'll get into why death symbolism is so important and substantial, because, you know, they look at things from the perspective that death is not something to be feared. It's a fact of nature and it needs to be embraced. You need to shed your fear of it.
Understanding that, how do they feel about their own death?
I think they just look at it like they want to do the greater good before they die. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing that's funny, because like the people I talk to in general who believe that there's like this hierarchy ruling the world, right? And I'm not saying that I don't believe that. I just believe it in a different way. They look at it like there is this hierarchy that's ruling the world, and those people are evil, and they are greedy. They're just wanting to be wealthy, rich, and powerful, and they're just ego cases. And there is some truth to that. There is definitely ego aspects to them. I think that they're misunderstood, but they don't understand that this idea of the New World Order is not an idea that is like this dark, conspiratorial, like police state. Yeah, there is police state reason. I mean, the thing is that like, everything is so wicked and evil and dark, but you don't look at it from their view. They look like they think they're creating a utopian society for all of us. They're doing it for us. They really believe that. And that's why they can get so many people behind them in their quest, their mission. You know, if it was really that dark and sinister, do you think so many people over such a long period of time would jump on the bandwagon? I mean, let's get real here. There's not that many people who are just inherently wicked. You know, that I mean, there's so many people. You're talking about, I got quotes from professors at universities. I mean, this is a philosophy. And we need to embrace that idea. This is not just politics. It's not just the quest for power. It is a philosophy.
Yeah, and important to remember too, these are people with, you know, children and spouses and friends. I mean,
right.
These aren't people who just kind of sit in a dark room typing out sinister and evil,
right,
you know, beliefs.
I mean, they have feelings. They have lives. They care about their young ones. But they just have a different worldview than most other people do. You know, and it's not a new worldview. It's been around for a long time. I mean, you know, you had to think about Hitler and his idea, his worldview is like he was helping the progress of mankind by getting rid of the Jews. That's what he believed. I mean, the people do believe this stuff. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with it. I'm not even trying to take a position, but I am just saying that the from what I understand from the stuff that I read, this is where they're coming from. It's a philosophic belief that affects their politics, and it comes from a understanding of religion that most people don't even know about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it's like a chain reaction. Now, this understanding of religion is not, how do I explain this? It is not just the different groups that are doing it. This is taught in college now. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's mainstream now.
Right.
This is not like hidden. It's mainstream. It's been watered down quite a bit. It lacks a lot of the aspects. But you have to understand that this has been an agenda that's been going on for several decades. Mm. I mean, it's been going on for a very long time. And it can be seen and can be proven to be true. When you get into the question of why, where does this belief come from and how, you know what I'm saying? That's when you start getting into the religious ideas, the history and whatnot. So, interesting quote. And I got another quote too. Okay.
Who's this?
This is Albert Pike, Morals and Dogma. Now, this is not to just shine a light on Masonry, because Masonry is just another organization, but it is to give you an idea of where he's coming from. Masonry, like all religions, all the mysteries, Hermeticism, and alchemy, conceals its secrets from all except the adepts, sages, or the elect, and uses false explanations and misinterpretations of its symbols to mislead those who deserve only to be misled. Wonder who those are who deserve to be misled.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Me? I don't know.
You know, that's what I get. Who? What makes somebody qualify to know the truth? I'm just wondering. You know, he never really gets to that, but
yeah, I kind of get the feeling it's those who realize it are the ones who are those who are who deserve to know it. It's those who figure it out.
Right, exactly. To conceal the truth, which it calls light, from them. Okay, light is knowledge. It says in the front of Albert Mackey's book, "Light is knowledge." Okay, from them, and to draw them away from it. Truth is not for those who are unworthy or unable to receive it. Unable to receive it. Unworthy. Or would pervert it. So God himself incapacitates many men by colorblindness to distinguish colors and leads the masses away from the highest truth. God does that?
Yeah.
Giving them the power to attain only so much as it is profitable to them to know. Every age has had a religion suited to its capacity. So every age has had a religion suited to its capacity to understand, right? The teachers, even of Christianity, are in general the most ignorant of the true meaning of which they teach. There is no book of which so little is known as the Bible. To most who read it, it is incomprehensible as the Zohar. So Masonry jealously conceals its secrets and intentionally leads conceited interpreters astray. There is no sight under the sun more pitiful and ludicrous at once than to the spectacle of Preston's and the Webbs, not to mention the latter incarnation of dullness in common... Like, I already read this, but... Anyways, you get the point, I hope. So, you know, so we're talking about Nimrod, we're talking about Babylon. They started out, supposedly civilization began there. So there's a lot to be said about it. Now, the Babylon is not that important, really. I'm not getting into it because it's full of importance. I'm getting into it because I'm trying to do a history lesson to some extent from this point forward. The next time we do a show on next Friday, we are going to do, I'm going to go through and I'm going to read quotes and things from their interpretations of Egypt. And the interesting part now, they don't claim to know everything. They claim that there is a descendant line that started out in ancient paganistic forms and you know, came to Babylon and Egypt and then into the Far East, and that those were they all came from the same place, and they have a lot of the same symbolism and same whatever, and then they draw connections between those, and from those outcrop of a lot of other beliefs in all these different mystery cults that eventually came to the Romans and the Greeks and so on. So we'll get into that next time. And I'm kind of think we should go for another break here.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This song is called "The Age of Television" by DJ Rob Swift. Another great song. Enjoy.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
Television. 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 Television.
Our guest is Rob Swift. Rob Swift.
Hey, fellas. What this sketch needs is a funny entrance for Alan.
Funny entrance?
Yeah.
How about a door with a sign on it that says, ha ha!
He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. Where's the man with a gun?
Murder of Lee Oswald? Well, we saw it right on the screen with Jack Ruby.
I regret the necessities of war. I regret the necessities of war.
Television. 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 Television.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you. together we can do for the freedom of man.
Today's secret drawing will be an astronaut.
Make a circle on the head. Stand
by for your TV. And we're getting a picture on the TV. Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. Although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it.
Right now in this country, there is one television set for every 1 2/3 person. What that other 1/3 of a guy is looking at, I will probably never know. But,
television.
Well, howdy, Mr. Duty. Well, howdy, Mr. Duty. And boys and girls at home and kids in the gallery, let's go!
I present to you Harriet Truman, the present and the next president of these United States.
Than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Rob Swift. Television.
For the day has just about ended.
Okay, we're back.
Cool track.
Yeah, trippy, huh? You're going to get some really interesting music from me, I promise you. So anyways, so basically, Justin, what did you... I was expecting to take calls, so...
I'll be your caller.
Yeah. I mean, because I was, you know, everything's gotten knocked off because of my computer issue, but... I'm going to try to get that fixed right now. But in the meantime, Justin?
I'm just going to try to talk here about what I think about it all, especially just what we've been talking about. the thing that is the most bothersome to me about all of this is really, I forget which book. Was it Levi? The quote you read about basically the slave and the master.
Right.
Right. And the idea of the passions being something that is worth overcoming, something that it's somehow a good thing to actually overcome and to, like, it's something that needs to be defeated. Like, this view, and you see it especially in, like, an academic setting, people who are real, real strongly in their head all the time, you know, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
You see that... Basically, people see that evolution led us to where we're at, so we can shed off, like we can shed off our emotions and our feelings. And I think that's the most dangerous part of all of this is this idea that it's almost like there's certain people that they can't stand the appearance of what they would call chaos that comes from when people actually have passions, actually have desires that they follow. And, you know, like the world isn't always nice and clean when people are kind of left to do what they want, quote unquote, or to act the way that they really are. It's not nice. It's messy, you know?
Right.
And personally, like, I think it's much more valuable to be able to look at the world like that and just say, you know what, that's something that I can embrace. I can allow that kind of chaos instead of feeling that you basically have to control and eliminate that kind of chaos.
Right.
Exactly. That's the thing I think of it all that is the most kind of irritating. But then back like on an intellectual level, what we were talking about early on, you know, control of the elements and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was kind of interesting that they would try to, not to pick on Masonry, Freemasonry, but that they would try to link Freemasonry back to like the earliest civilization, what at the time was known as the earliest civilization, and imagining when you do that and look at it in that light and from that perspective, the control of it's the control of stone. It's another example of control over elements, which mm-hmm. is really interesting, because I think when you take it only back to like Solomon's Temple, you're so far already into modern world, and you're so modern, you know, in a sense, modern compared to caveman, you know.
Right.
You're so far into like a world that in some way we can recognize that it's no big deal. Like, there were already Masons before Solomon's Temple. You know, there were people who worked with stone. There were people who worked with fire. All that stuff was established. But when you bring it back to like Nimrod and the earliest civilizations, whether you think it's Nineveh or Babylon or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you suddenly place it historically, you place it as something that has been at the forefront of like the evolution of humanity all along.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting, because to me, it's like, just as, you know, person who realized that they could tame fire, you know, realized something fundamental about the universe. And then you've got the people who started with agriculture. You've got, you know, the Tigris and Euphrates and the civilizations that rose up there based mm-hmm. on agriculture and the controlling like that. And then you add to this that in some way Masonry is another level, another way of controlling the surroundings and realizing that you have power over what before you were powerless over. I mean, what's a rock but a piece of a mountain taken, you know, and what does a mason do but sculpt it and use something that was wild and untamed, mm-hmm. you know, and takes it, twists it, makes it something that they can use for their own purpose and their own good.
Right, absolutely. And it's funny that you use that analogy, because that definitely is an analogy that's often used in Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. I think that has to do with what they call the rough ashlar. We'll get into that in another time, but it's about shaping stone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about making something out of using your intellect. And I think it's a large part of Masonry, most people who are involved in it don't see it for that. I think that's what's really interesting about it. I mean, because when I was reading it, and I say this because I came from a place of hearing conspiracy theories about Freemasonry to getting a Freemason's book in my hand, reading it, and being convinced that he's right. I mean, I wasn't totally convinced. I definitely had – there was still – I mean, the fact that I had read a conspiracy book before then that mentioned Freemasonry and some things about it was what kept me going,
right.
I need to look into this. You know what I'm saying? I need to make sure this is true. But, you know, it's what kept me from joining, basically. Let's just put it that way, because I was convinced. I was all about it. And the funny thing that I think is really ironic – this is the whole thing – is that this is all stuff I believed. It wasn't like I dug this stuff up and made up this elaborate story to kind of show it, you know, these groups in a bad light or anything. This is what I believed. Mm-hmm. This is what I felt like I was being taught. And it wasn't until later that I read a few books on people on Masonry and things that people had to say that I was like, wow, you know, that's exactly what I'm getting out of it. They're right. You know what I'm saying? To some extent. Mm-hmm. But they didn't understand most of the stuff that they were quoting. They didn't really understand why. They didn't have the why behind it. And it took me a while to get to a place where I was like, okay, there are some problems here that I disagree with. And that's where I'm coming from now. When I did the interview with the 32nd degree Freemason, I voiced my objections to Freemasonry. Not all of them, but a good portion of why I never joined was this elitist mentality that I just can't stand. I can't stand that. You know, like, I understand there's some people who are smarter than others. Okay, you know, that's cool. But this idea that you're somehow more valuable because you're intellectual or that you should have the right to decide things on behalf of other people because you get it, it just drives me crazy.
Yeah. And another thing that's interesting, it's like when we're talking about this as kind of a broad worldview, it's a strange thing it reminds me of. I'm trying to get good at chess right now in my life. Like, I don't know why I've become fascinated with it. I'm not that great at it, you know. Uh-huh. So I'm not even going to tell you how you can play me on chess.com and what my name is, because it's embarrassing. I'm bad. But the interesting thing about it, and then also remembering Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard. Okay, so here's where I'm going with this, is you take these views, okay, you know, something like, as a for instance, the supremacy of an intellectual over anyone else. You take that view, and if you just stop there, it's okay. Like, I can understand people are, yeah, okay, I understand that. You're intellectual, you're somehow maybe, you know, you're better, you deserve more, whatever. But the problem is you got to look forward to what that means. Like in chess, you look like, some people can look like 20 or 30 moves forward. It's ridiculous. And see that what looks like, you know, a move that isn't going to really cause all that much damage is actually going to make me lose the game,
right,
ultimately.
Right.
And that's what it's like. It's really just taking, it's like, take these philosophies and really drive them to the end and see where they lead. Because a lot of it might sound good and a lot of it, you know, you might think you agree with, but you got to follow it all the way to the end. And I think it's really, it's an interesting way to look at it, that it's like, what is the end of all this? I mean, you know, when I was asking Carl before, it's like, is the end of all of this that you really don't, you don't feed the stupid people? I mean, is that is that like you let them die? Is that really where what it's headed towards? You know, is that what all of this wonderful quote unquote intellectualism is leading to?
Yeah.
Don't feed.
No offense to stupid people. No.
I got to get a shirt that says that.
Don't feed the stupid people.
No. You know, it. I guess it's, I don't like to encapsulate a belief in every aspect of this, because there's different people who believe different stuff. And they all come from a slightly different place, and they all have slightly different reasons why they believe things to be either true or not true. So, I guess what it boils down to is kind of like Plato's Republic, this view that there are certain people who are good at certain things. And that those people should naturally do the things that they're best at. Mm-hmm. And some people's talent is to think, and others are not. So you wouldn't want a fool running the government. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? You wouldn't want,
definitely,
you know, a person who can't, you know, stand pain should never work in hard labor.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There's just different aspects, I guess, to different people. And they kind of look at it as a way of producing a more functional society. And the utopian vision is, of course, is based upon like, oh, there's no war, there's no hunger, there's no this, there's no that, you know. But like, the problem is with this is that whenever people get too much power, and we've seen it before, they start coming up with other things that they think would be a lot better. Like, okay, you know, I really just don't think that there should be Jews. Mm-hmm. They're really holding us back in our progress. We need to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And of course, everything always sounds good when you're one of those so-called elites. But put yourself in the position of one of the people who they decided they need to get rid of.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Doesn't make sense. It's really bad.
Yeah. I can't remember what it was you just said. It totally sparked something in my mind. But going back to Plato's Republic, that's what it was. What's interesting about that is that there's something of like a compassion that shines through the idea that all people should be doing what they're best at.
Mm-hmm.
Where the little complication that to me screws everything up is that some people think they're best at knowing what other people are good at, which is like, that's the scary thing right there. It's like, okay, I mean, in a way I love that idea of, you know, all of us, you know, doing what we're good at, what we're passionate about, so, which isn't always the same thing, I admit. And that's kind of, you know, I might not be passionate at what I'm good at and good at what I'm passionate at, but I like the idea. But it's when you throw in the idea of controlling other people, and make, you know, like herding them into what you think they should be doing, is like, that's where it all falls apart.
Absolutely. And it's not just controlling. I mean, there's different forms of control. There's the kind of control where you tell people lies to make them think things that are not true. Mm-hmm. There's the kind of control with we withhold the truth to prevent them from knowing the truth, because these are all forms of control. And, you know, like I was talking to Greg. He might be listening right now, by the way, because he asked. Hi, Greg, if you're listening. the thing about when I talked to him, you know, on the podcast interview, I wanted to dig into some of the deeper elements of Freemasonry, because I have objections that are even deeper. They go down to the very philosophic core of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. The thing is, in order to talk about those things, I need to bring up aspects about Freemasonry. But he can't talk to me about it. He's sworn not to. Well, how convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very convenient thing to a position to take, because, and not just for him, I'm not saying him personally, because I know all Freemasons feel that way. And he did, in fact, take an oath. But the oath is there for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
The really essence of an oath is not to what do you call it, to prove that you're somehow
like dedicated
to the group, or that you're, you know, you have a lot of integrity because you won't tell the truth, you know, the truth about the group or whatever. It's not about that, and a lot of people don't understand the idea of the concealment. The concealment is not because there's things going on that most people would object to. Perhaps there is. Let's just say that there is. Perhaps there is. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But from what I get is that the idea is that most people, if you told them the truth, number one, wouldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Like say for some reason I had this profound realization that there is no God. I just figured it out. I proved it, and I wanted to go tell everybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
I started walking around. There is no God. Did you know that? And the people would look at me like, yeah, there is.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm serious. There isn't. Here, let's sit down. Let me do a teaching with you, and I'll teach you.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you, if even if that was the truth, it would not work. You can't. There's various realizations. I mean, even if, just flip it. Say I have a realization that Christ is God, and that the Bible is 100% true, and I want to go around and preach it, and they do. Mm-hmm. You know? And what good would it do for me to walk up to somebody and say, Jesus is Lord? Did you know that? You know, they would look at you like you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or they would agree with you even. I don't know. But my point being is that you know, just going out and saying these things, these are things that people have to figure out on their own and through experience and so on. And the idea behind concealment is not, I didn't feel so much that there's a secret involved as much as it is that it doesn't matter if we tell you the truth about it, because you won't get it. Now, the idea behind a concealment was that, you know, if the say, for example, that these people, like I believe, really do at the higher ups or whatever the purpose of the group is to kind of prove that there is no God and that man is in control of his own destiny, then I believe that they would have to keep that a secret if you're talking about a country, say, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. where the vast majority of them would, you know, definitely come and lynch you if you said things mm-hmm. like that. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
it's not acceptable.
It's got another, there's another result to the concealment, though, which is, in a way, it doesn't squash dissent, but it mm-hmm. definitely keeps debate among a very set group of people who mm-hmm. are all, in one way or another, at least coming from somewhat of the same place. I mean,
right.
like you're saying, when you're talking to this guy, you can't get to the core of things because you can't even talk about the elements that lead to whatever these fundamental issues are that you have. I mean,
right.
when it's all so much of a secret like that, it's like it's completely closing itself off to criticism.
Absolutely. That's so frustrating to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, the thing is like, I've talked to many Freemasons and they open up to me. You know, I don't know if they don't tell me. If I already know, they can agree or disagree. They can't tell me because that's part of breaking their oath. I think they're allowed to talk about it to some extent or either agree or disagree. And they do it and they're very meticulous, trust me, about how they say things and how they talk about it. However, if you try to get them in front of a group of people to have a logical debate about it, it ain't going to happen. They're not going to talk to you about it. You can bring up everything. They can respond to things like the Lucifer quote, and you know what I'm saying. But they can never get into things like the very fundamentals, like the lost word of Freemasonry. That's such a huge part of the ritual and what it means. And the lost word of Freemasonry is supposedly the name of God, and you're given a number of replacements. And it's what it does is, if you get into that, it shows that the purpose behind the rituals and the purpose behind the degrees is to teach you a pathway to trying to find the name of God. Mm-hmm. What is God? Basically, it's like, who's God? That's what it's about. You know what I'm saying? That's why there's so many religions involved in it and things of that sort. And I mean, it's a very thick philosophy. There's so many symbols and so many different facets of it. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that if I am going to try to discuss things about that and say that, for example, and I said this, what if it is about, you know, Lucifer being God? Okay.
Yeah. What if it is?
I disagree with it. I want to talk about it. Let's talk about it and see who's right and wrong. Or maybe you can give me some clarification on how it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen because they won't talk about it. Frustrating.
Yeah.
To say the least.
It's just, it is frustrating. It's not, some things are just not open. I guess, I don't know if that's the right way to put it. Not open to debate or whatever. The other thing, going back to like the elitism of it all, is that's so interesting. And I might have a total misunderstanding about this, but when it comes to these things, like, okay, trying to find a path to understanding who God is, I mean, which must also lead somewhat to an understanding of why you're even here in the first place. And it's basically like, it's all men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And up until probably, you know, fairly recently, it's all white men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, not only can you, they not talk about it, but it's not even something that can be shared with, they can only be shared with like a certain class and type of person who falls into very certain particular, I don't know, demographic, whatever, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's especially, well, they have like a female version of Freemasonry.
Yeah.
They have a black version of Freemasonry, and they even allow, I guess, from my understanding now, black people into actual Freemasonry.
Yeah, I read an article about that the other day. It was there was a guy, a black guy, who was saying that he was a Freemason in Los Angeles. And so, I mean, I'm not saying it's exactly the same now.
Right.
But
then again, the purpose of the organization has been altered, because when you're dealing in the past, like, okay, there's various aspects of why they say the organization exists in the first place. And one of those aspects are that they were maintaining a knowledge that had been handed down through the Dark Ages secretly because it was being suppressed. Okay, and it ended up in their hands for whatever reason, and they made a whole thing about it. It's that whole mysticism thing. That's one thing I've read multiple times from Freemasons. But, you know, from my own studies, basically what I've come to realize is that purpose of Freemasonry was to recruit members. Hmm. Like, you couldn't, like I said, you couldn't just walk up to somebody and say, there is no God, and expect that person to go, you're right. Yeah, you're right. That's true. So the purpose of the organization was to basically slowly, one bite at a time, teach you about the different religions, the different connections, and the different aspects of it. And you start out really simple, and you get deeper and deeper and deeper, and you look at all the symbols, and you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to the very end, having made all these these connections, you're supposed to take that information and apply it to something. Well, I find it very interesting that there's two types of people that I normally talk to that are high-level Masons, that this is the two different positions they're coming from. One is mystic is almost always the case. Almost all of them get to be very mystic. All religions are kind of one religion.
Right.
It's part of the sacred energy, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
They get into the metaphysics sometimes, some at various lengths. Some are deeper, some are less deep. But then there's the ones who look at religion as like not really, no, with no superstition whatsoever. It's purely philosophic. And that's where the whole like theosophy idea came from. Whichever she's very religious. But the thing is, and sometimes she, I mean Blavatsky, yeah. The thing is that, you know, the purely philosophic ones don't actually believe any of these people actually existed. Most of them are just they're all just basically referring to an ancient religion, and the myths have been expanded upon over and over and over again to create these elaborate things with all the symbolism, but that they originate with some form of astrotheology. And that they're, you know, it has to do with the stars and the moon and this and that. And they get into it, and they're really into the culture aspect of it. But they don't look at it as, you know, they're part of a religion. They look at they're more or less atheists. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of hard, because if I asked them, are you an atheist, they would say no. It's funny.
What do they mean by no?
That's so funny, because when you read Albert Pike, you know, where so much of what he had to say was sounded like he was getting at atheism.
Right.
At least that's what I got from it. And then when he talks about atheism as being the lowest form, even worse than people who are religious.
Hmm.
Which is it's fascinating, and the really interesting part is, and this is kind of what I've come to understand, is that atheism, that is enlightened atheism, somebody who understands where the religions come from and acknowledges the different energies and sciences and things like that, who came to the knowledge and the realization through education and intellect, are not atheists, or they would never admit to being atheists, mm-hmm. but they do have a lot of atheistic aspects to them. Then there's the atheists that just don't believe in God, and they looked at as more or less people who refuse to believe in God because of their immorality, which is the kind of that they look down upon.
Right.
Because they're not intellectual atheists. They're atheists who have abandoned God because of immorality.
So we're like almost in a way talking about more like a dogmatic atheist, someone who is in being an atheist is as fundamentalist as the craziest, you know, whatever, fundamentalist Christian, Muslim, whatever.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the that's what I basically believe. When they get to the top of this ladder or whatever that is or whatever, you know, I think that the whole process is, it's not like it's ever revealed to them. They're just supposed to get it.
Mm-hmm.
At least I know that many. And if that at the very least, if you don't want to believe that that's what they're taught, at least believe this. A lot of them believe that.
Right.
A lot of them think that way, whether or not it's intended.
Yeah, and that's, again, kind of what I was... goes back to what I was talking about a little bit earlier, and it's that you got to look ahead to where this, what does this lead to? What's the belief system that this leads to? What are the necessary things that this is actually saying?
Right.
You know, you can't pretend that it's not there.
Right. And you know, let's just speculate for a second. What would that lead to? Well, let's see. If I don't believe in God and I believe that destiny is in the hands of man, and that it would be best suited if mankind was ruled by people who are more intellectual like myself.
Right.
Well, let's see. What kind of conclusions would I come to? Number one, people should not rule themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a foolish idea. However, I would know that if they don't think that they rule themselves, then we have a problem because they'll try to eliminate.
They'll try to eliminate those who are in charge. Yeah.
Right. So we need to at least come up with some kind of idea of them ruling themselves when mm-hmm. they really don't.
Yeah.
Sound familiar?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's what it, you know. Let's think about other things. I would realize that in order for us to maintain our superiority over the world, we would have to be in control of the whole world and not just a country.
Hmm.
Therefore, we would need to, whether through secret means or through direct force, whatever, we'd have to apprehend the governments of the world so that we can maintain ourselves as the leaders and that we would never have a challenger.
Mm-hmm.
So I would know that in order to prevent some charismatic leaders from coming up, and leading people to come against me that may know the truth or not, I would have to have somewhat of a surveillance state to make sure that the people who are a potential threat are identified and eliminated.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think this is the kind of things that it's funny because I know what the world is like today, so it's easy for me to kind of draw these yeah. conclusions. But when you get into like things like, you know, what we're reading with Zbigniew Brzezinski, for example, I mean, that's exactly what he says. I mean,
yeah,
he gets
it is.
It's this... Unbelievable.
And it's interesting because it's interesting where it does, where this thought process doesn't lead. Like, okay, maybe it's not necessarily going to be the case that all those things are going to happen, although it seems to be the case that they have. But I'm just saying hypothetically, there's not like a good thing. Okay, and I know when I say good, I'm setting myself up for all sorts of trouble, but there's not a good end to any of this. None of these options are good options. They're all options that basically consider themselves, one considers oneself as a higher being more or less, and one considers the other as something to be dealt with in some way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. let's get into this, because because now we're kind of going full circle here. Let me read some Brzezinski quotes, and you can see, and you make a decision, you listeners out there, you make a decision if this sounds like a place he's coming from. I mean, and we'll see what you think. Okay. So I'm going to go through a number of key quotes and listen. You know, this is also going to – I'm just going to go through, because I'm not going to – I don't have time to go through and pick out the ones that make the most sense. But I'll just go through it. You know, we got time, so let's go through it here. Ever since continents started interacting politically some 500 years ago, Eurasia has been the center of world power. But in the meantime, I'm skipping through the book, and this is the quotes that I read during another podcast. But in the meantime, it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also challenging America. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is therefore the purpose of this book.
Well, that's, I mean, you hit it. You already hit it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing just reeks of this mentality. You know what I'm saying? In that context, how America manages Eurasia is critical. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced economically productive regions. A mere glance at the map would also suggest that control over Eurasia would automatically entail Africa's subordination, rendering the Western Hemisphere and Oceania geopolitically peripheral to the world's central continent. About 75% of the world's people live in Eurasia, and most of the world's physical wealth is there as well, both in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia accounts for 3/4 of the world's known energy resources. Okay, this is where it gets fun. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. But the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public sense of domestic well-being. The economic self-denial, that is, defense spending, and the human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers, required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization.
Which is basically to say that regular people are kind of a hindrance to the elite taking power over the world. I mean, that's seems to me like that's a pretty fair rephrasing.
Right, exactly. In the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. Hence, America is not only the first as well as the only truly global superpower, but is likely also to be the very last. I mean, and this is very, you know, it's really wordy, but if you get to the essence of what he's saying, I mean, he goes in here and he talks about how democracy and basically his vision for the future of our country is they're just not going to work together. So which one do you think is going to go?
Yeah, and his vision isn't, I mean, it's framed as an American vision, but it's a global vision, you know? I mean, yeah. America might happen to be the means at this point. But it's a global vision. It's not just like it's not the good old USA.
Yeah. Oh man. There's another book I did. I hope you go back and listen to my podcast. The website's truthlovefreedom.org.
Oh, yeah.
Go to the right side. Go to the podcast category. You can listen to it right off of the site. There is. I went through Between Two Ages. Fascinating book.
Out of print.
Yeah, wonderful book for understanding the mentality of our, you know, leaders and who this guy is. If you don't know, definitely do some research on Mr. Zbigniew Brzezinski. He's a piece of work. And so, anyways, want to have the floor for a second?
Oh boy, I get the floor. It's so fascinating to me that this always comes. It's so easy to go from talking about like thousands and thousands of years ago and kind of ideas about how religion itself sprung from whatever, you know, we're talking about theories about how the things that we now consider part of regular everyday human life even came into existence in the first place, can so easily be drawn into like comparisons and parallels regarding today, like and the way that things are being steered today and where things are going today. It's like it's fascinating. And I know you know, like kind of we've been talking about earlier, it's not really about whether or not this is really the way that things happen, that this is, you know, really where religion comes from or whatever, but it's about this idea that there's like a fixed mentality that's been, that you can almost trace a line of a certain philosophy all the way back, as far back as you can go, and whether or not you know exactly how it happened, there's some pretty kind of compelling, interesting anyway, arguments that there's always been this mentality of that it's okay, it's possible for okay isn't even the right word, but that it basically is the case that there are superior people, there are elites, and they are supposed to be, they are entitled to be in control. They're the ones who are entitled, and that it's not a matter of proving that or fighting for that. It's just a matter of facilitating it. Like, okay, it's a given. It's like it's accepted as a given, and probably, you know, has been more or less for thousands of years, at least by some. And as a given, it means that the whole point, like I said, not to prove that it's true, but just to make it so.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very well said.
lucky me.
And, you know, God, I just wish we had the phones working right now. I'm still trying to get that to work, but it's just not working. And I apologize. For the next radio show, we will have phones.
Let's hope.
Come hell or high water. And we're also going to do an interview with the 32nd degree Freemason. Dude, call in and ask the guy questions, you know. And, of course, you got to realize that, you know, he's coming from his own place and whatever. You know, he may not... He may not agree with everything that we're saying. It's likely that he will agree with hardly anything that I say. Let's rephrase that for a second. But you know, if you get into things and you get into the concepts and stuff like that, you know, he'll acknowledge, at least that's what I thought was really cool about him, is that he actually at least acknowledged the possibility that it could be true. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to get into things. Like, the people talk about the Illuminati, right? Ruled, you know, or used Freemasonry as like a recruiting ground, and they had all these agendas, and one of them was the elimination of the nations. One was the elimination of religion, ecclesiastical religion, and whatever. You know, it's like, and you know, I guess the thing is that what I'm trying to say is that every time you get into the politics of the aspects of this, it always goes along with the same mentality. Now, there are so many different organizations involved in this. Freemasonry is not the only one, and I don't mean to point them out all the time. I'm not against Freemasons. And let me state for the record, I am not against Freemasons. I like Freemasons. Most Freemasons that I talk to are a lot of fun to talk to. They're not dumb. I mean, they'll talk philosophical with you for a long period of time, and I enjoy that. I have no problem with them. I have no problem with their beliefs. I believe everybody should believe whatever they want to believe. But I do have a problem with aspects of Freemasonry, particularly the elitist aspect, the idea that somebody knows better than me. And I believe, and I believe I can prove, that most of what's going on in the governments of the world today, I'm not saying that they're all Freemasons, but I'm saying a large portion of the philosophy and mentality that has developed over the years, if it is from the mystery schools, if it is directly from Freemasonry or not, I think Freemasonry has an aspect to do with it, has shaped the direction in which our world has been going. I mean, needless to say, every Freemason that I've ever met loves Freemasonry. They don't just like it. It's not like the Elks Club where they just go and they screw around with other guys. Mm-hmm. They love Freemasonry. They get livid if you ever talk bad about it. Angry. Furious. So there's something deep going on there involving Freemasonry. And it's not like, I mean, if I belong to the Boy Scouts and somebody talked bad about the Boy Scouts, I'd be like, okay, no big deal. I don't think the Boy Scouts would ever like want to beat you down. But you know, I've talked to Freemasons before where, you know, it was like they were shouting at me through the freaking internet. You know what I'm saying? Like they
all
were
all caps, right?
Yeah, all caps, angry, furious. How dare you say that? Blah blah blah. Like I made a comment on one of my on my show that I think I sent an email. I'm trying to remember, how did this work? I think I sent a post out and I basically said that Freemasonry is not benevolent in any way. And I should have rephrased that because I didn't actually mean it in those terms because they have hospitals and things like that. However, what my point was that that's not the intention of Freemasonry as much as they try to make it sound like it is. The organization, they didn't develop all these symbols to just make men better, make them give money to charity. Give me a break. I mean, these things are so deep and so thick. The philosophy, the symbolism is so incredibly thick that it's obviously much, much deeper. And yeah, the commitment of its members is very deep.
And when you say something like that it's not a benevolent organization, that is in the face of the fact that there are benevolent things that may come out of it, benevolent actions, maybe even benevolent people from time to time. But the thing is, we're talking again about where does it lead? Where does it all lead to? And that's what we're really talking about. Right. You know, it's like it's one that, yeah, you can open all the children's hospitals you want. It's a great thing. But if at the end of the day you're discounting basically the humanity of the vast majority of the world.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, and this is directed to any Freemasons that may be listening or people who are apologists for them. Like I said, I'm not against you. But let me ask you one fundamental question, and I really want you to ponder this concept. Okay. Is there people in the world that you believe should not be in Freemasonry because of their inability to understand the stuff? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering. Like, I don't know. Like, I know not all Freemasons believe this, but some of them do. And I definitely wonder if you're coming from that mentality, do you think that you're somehow better than other people? Do you believe that Freemasonry is better than other belief systems or any other organizations out there? You know what I'm saying? I just wonder if people ever ask themselves these questions. Because I know if you asked them in that term, they would probably be like, no, because they know it would be a wrong thing to say.
Yeah, because no one's going to say, yeah, of course I believe it's better than every other system. Someone will probably answer and they'll say, oh, no, of course people should believe what they want. And of course it's not better than any other. Well, then, is there anyone out there who you think should not be allowed to, you know, ask that question again?
Right. I mean, I know that they would say people like crooks and people who would do like bad things, bad people. They always, you know,
bad.
But they, you know, they have the motto. I thought this was really funny. I listened to this guy say something one time. He goes, it was pretty funny. He goes, Freemasonry claims to make good men better, but they have no aspect of them says that they make bad men good. And they've certainly had some pretty bad people in there, in my opinion. You know what I'm saying? And just because you're a Freemason doesn't mean you're a good person. I mean, and I think they would agree with that. And there's some questionability about Albert Pike and his involvement with the Ku Klux Klan and things like that. But it is interesting. I'm hoping to get, I would like to get one Freemason. If there's any Freemasons listening by any chance, I don't know if there is, but if there is, who would be interested in possibly doing an interview, and who does somehow believe that Freemasonry is basically better than everything else, that would be interesting to talk to you.
Yeah.
I don't know if they would ever, you know, come on the show or anything like that, but we got Greg Stewart coming on, and he's gonna, it's gonna be interesting. I'm gonna ask him some of these aspects. He was honest about it. When I did the interview with him, I asked him. I said, you know, that one of my objections is that Freemasonry is very elitist, and he said, yeah, it's true. And he didn't deny it. Yeah, it's true. I mean, it would be hard to deny. I mean, because I've met so many of them that have their nose so high up in the air, it's like. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. Like, I've tried, you know, digging into them, asking them questions, and just wanting to talk philosophy. And that was, a lot of times I get treated like, you just don't understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's ridiculous. So anyways, so in the next show, the subject matter is going to be continuing on this subject matter. I'm going to go now beyond the foundations of the government of Babylon. I'm going to get into the religious aspects and the symbolism according to those who claim to be members of the mystery schools. And it's going to be a slow and gradual process. Every show I'm probably going to put in about 30 minutes to an hour of just reading. I hope you can bear with it. And if you don't like the aspect, go to my website, truthlovefreedom.org, and send me an email and say, don't do that. It's boring.
Yeah.
And we'll figure out another way to do it.
Or, you know, do it with music or dramatic voices or something.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to get this stupid laptop working so we can take phone calls and do some other fun stuff. I was planning on getting content and playing interviews and things like that, but I couldn't do it because of the fact that
the laptop
I was spending my whole time just trying to get it to play music.
Yeah.
So, and that's how it goes, I guess.
Yep.
And that's why we ramble on and on and on. So.
But you love it.
Yeah, maybe. All right, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get going. I'm going to put on an outro song, but... TruthLoveFreedom.org. Oh, before we go, one last thing.
Oh.
Bohemian Grove is about to have their meeting. I hope they're not already having it. They're not having it right yet. They're having it in like 2 weeks. I am trying to raise money for a little unit. It's about $400. And what it will allow me to do is use my cell phone as a way to broadcast a radio signal to the station so I can use it to call in and basically have good quality and go around and interview people with my mic. And I want to go to Bohemian Grove and do a live broadcast as the people are coming. I need to come in on Friday night, too, so it'd be perfect, right, in time for the show. This is the time we do it, and cool. It's perfect timing. So if you want us there, please go to the website, truthlovefreedom.org, and click on the Donate tab and donate to us for that cause. And if it can add up to enough, I'll do a live broadcast from the Bohemian Grove. I'll go around interviewing people and talking to people and telling you what's going on as it happens.
Cool.
It'll be a lot of fun. I think it will be. All right, everybody. Truthlovefreedom.org. Peace out.
See ya.
See ya.